Penguin Random House Audio presents The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children by Suzanne Bouffard. Read for you by Therese Plummer. Prologue. 60 parents clustered in the cafeteria of the Elliott K-8 Innovation School, some balancing toddlers on their hips, others finishing their morning coffee. "Welcome to the best public school in Boston," Principal Tracy Griffith greeted them, warmly, and without the ego that one might imagine to accompany such a statement. It wasn't long into her overview, which she'd been giving for months during similar school tours, before an anxious parent asked, "How many pre-K spots do you have for next year?" "We have 32 seats," Griffith replied smoothly, quickly adding, "But we have 4 kindergarten classrooms, so that means there are 44 new seats in kindergarten every year." That provided little reassurance for the parents who would soon be entering their 4-year-olds in the Boston Public Schools BPS lottery. Griffith didn't have to say what many already knew. All but 3 of the Elliott's current pre-K students had been virtually guaranteed a spot because they had a sibling already attending the school. The odds were long for Luca Murthy, but he was blissfully unaware of the stress his parents and so many others were carrying. Luca was only 3 and was more concerned with Legos than lotteries. But he would turn 4 before the next school year, making him eligible for one of the nation's most successful public pre-kindergarten programs, or what the Boston Public Schools call K-1. The grade traditionally called kindergarten is known as K-2. Luca, his family's firstborn, wouldn't have the advantage of a sibling spot at the Elliott, and he wasn't guaranteed a K-1 spot at all. The Boston program serves only about 2,500 children, around half the city's 4-year-olds. Above the cafeteria, in Jody Krause's classroom, it was easy to see why parents wanted to send their children to the Elliott for pre-K. 16 children were engrossed in activities, set up at tiny natural wood furniture and in woven baskets full of books, puzzles, and art supplies. They were energetic and talkative, but calm and focused. On the rug, some used large wooden blocks to experiment with ramps and how fast toy cars would go depending on the angle of the blocks. At the easel, Krause asked 2 girls what they were painting and wrote their responses on the bottom of the paper so that when she hung it up later, everyone could see their thought processes. A quiet, reluctant boy got a hug from Krause and a reminder that his mother would be coming home from a business trip that night. "Yesterday, you made a great double-decker bus out of Play-Doh. Do you want to make another one?" Krause suggested. "Oh, look, your friend wants to know what a double-decker bus is." She bent down, gently touching the boy's shoulders, encouraging him to look directly at the other child and share his expertise with her. Krause had told me that she chose to teach at the Elliott because you feel a lot of joyfulness here, and the parents on the tour seemed to sense it too. Krause seemed to accomplish the impossible task of noticing everything happening in the room at once, providing just the right question or comment to nudge the children to think a little more deeply. When a child proudly approached her with a book he had made using familiar story characters, she shared his enthusiasm and then prodded him to write down the words the characters might say. Watching children mixing and painting with watercolors, she asked them, "What happens when you use different sized paintbrushes?" When she used the word water while talking about painting, she noticed that a nonverbal child used sign language to say drink, showing she heard Krause's words. Another boy came over to show her how he had pasted the letters of his name on cardstock. "Wow, you have 8 letters in your name," Krause exclaimed. "Do you have the longest name? Go find Olivia's name. Find the one that starts with an O. Now count how many. What about Matthew?" When she asked him how he got his correct answer of 7, he cheerfully replied, "I counted already." It was obvious that every moment of the school day was thoughtfully planned to facilitate children's learning, and that appealed to Luca's mother, Maria Fenwick. an educational consultant and former Boston Public Schools teacher, Fenwick had done her homework. She had long known about the Elliott and been drawn to the hands-on experiential learning that is a hallmark of the school. She had heard that Griffith and her staff were knowledgeable and dedicated, and that was clear in room 105 from the rhyming songs Krauss led during morning meeting to build vocabulary and language skills. "How are you, Caribou? I'm fine, Porcupine." To the way she asked children to tell her stories that would be transcribed and later acted out by the class. Fenwick was particularly impressed with the way that evidence of the students' learning covered the walls. At children's eye level were detailed self-portraits they had drawn during a unit on color, birth certificates created for pretend infants during a unit on families, photographs of block architecture annotated with descriptions of how the children made them. Each child's contribution was unique and creative. No evidence of photocopied worksheets anywhere. Almost any parent would walk into Krauss's classroom and want to send her child there. But few get that opportunity. The 32 spots at the Elliott, a nearly 100-year-old school located in the city's historic North End, are among the most coveted in the district. When I call parents to tell them they have a spot at our school, I get to tell them, "You have won the lottery, literally," says Tracy Griffith. Less than 10 years ago, however, the Elliott was undersubscribed, ranked near the very bottom of the city schools, a site of hopelessness and apathy that had been abandoned by neighborhood families. Less than a block away from the Elliott are a statue of school alumnus Paul Revere in the spot where he began his famous midnight ride, and the old North Church where patriots hung lanterns to give the one if by land, two if by sea signal. The change that has taken place at the Elliott has been less fiery than the war fought by the American patriots, but no less transformational. The introduction of the K-1 program wasn't solely responsible for the transformation, but it played an important role, drumming up parent interest in the school, building early and long-lasting relationships between children and staff, and laying the crucial foundation for school success that high-quality preschool can provide. The Boston Public Schools K-1 program is part of a growing national movement for public pre-kindergarten, or pre-K. Every year, over 1.5 million American children are enrolled in pre-K programs funded by public dollars, and thousands more attend private preschools, for a total of about 66% of the nation's four-year-olds. But for most of the remaining third of children, preschool is out of reach for financial or logistical reasons. Unlike most other industrialized countries, the United States has not made a serious commitment to early childhood education. We rank 28th out of 38 countries in the percentage of four-year-olds enrolled in programs, in large part because we don't fund pre-K for everyone. In countries like the United Kingdom, research has convinced policymakers and the public that pre-K should be a universal right, with guaranteed funding just like kindergarten through 12th grade. But there is growing demand for pre-K in the United States. Parents and educators use a variety of terms, including pre-K, preschool, and nursery school, and there is no standard definition. For example, in the Boston Public Schools, 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds can enroll in K-0, K-1, and K-2, respectively. While in charter schools I visited in Washington, D.C., 3-year-olds were in classrooms called preschool, while 4-year-old classrooms were called pre-K. In recent surveys, around 90% of parents believe that the preschool years are a critical period of development, and policymakers are beginning to agree. Cities from Seattle to New York have allocated public funding for municipal and district pre-K programs, housed in elementary schools, early childhood centers, or a combination of settings. Most of these programs are limited in size or eligibility criteria, but a few offer a pre-K spot to any family who wants one, like New York City, which created slots for nearly 70,000 four-year-olds, and Washington, D.C., which is one of the only places that offers a free spot not only for every four-year-old, but every three-year-old as well.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?